Long before the Netflix series Queer Eye became a sensation, Tan France first found himself in Utah. Tan is the fashion expert in the cast. He's Muslim Pakistani from South Yorkshire, England, a long way from the American West. He says he can't explain why, but he loved Utah, loved it right away. It's where he lives now. And early on, he came to work for a company in the state called Shade Clothing. Tan says if you're LDS and a woman, you probably know about Shade Clothing. They made modest clothes for Mormon women, undershirts to wear over their temple garments. And Tan loved the owner. She didn't care he wasn't Mormon, didn't care he was gay, but she didn't entirely prepare him for his first day.
My first day, there was a meeting of all the executives. I came in, and I had stopped in at Starbucks. And I think almost everybody else that worked for the business was LDS. And so I walked in my Starbucks. Hi, everyone. Nice to meet you. I sat at the table, and somebody that worked for the company, who was a very senior director, she said, wait, are you going to drink that? What do you mean, am I going to drink that? Are you going to drink your coffee in this meeting? Absolutely, I'm going to drink my coffee in this meeting. And it wasn't me trying to be difficult. I truly had no idea what she was talking about. I didn't realize that they didn't drink coffee. And then thankfully the owner was coming in at the time. And she said, oh, Tan, the reason why they're asking that is because Mormons ordinarily don't drink coffee. And she said to the director, you will never ask him that question again. He is not LDS. Many of our employees may not be active LDS or LDS. They get to drink whatever beverage they want at our meetings. Never ask that again.
It was also a culture clash. Was it then you realized?
Yes. And I also have a terrible potty mouth. Most English people swear very, very regularly. It's in our everyday vernacular.
And the big ones.
Yes. It's a cultural difference. We just articulate ourselves differently. And we show excitement differently.
Do you remember the first F word that you dropped?
Yep, it was in that meeting. It was in that meeting.
So you brought coffee and a curse word.
And I swore, I did. And everybody flinched. And the owner was like, he's not swearing at us. He is just showing his excitement. That's what they do in England. Move on.
It's funny. She was having to explain the South Asian gay guy to the Mormon crowd.
Yes. Yeah. She set the tone for my experience at that company. And I was like, okay, I love this woman. And I will work for her for as long as she'll have me.
I'm Doug Fabrizio. And today on Radio West, Tan France is our guest. He's written a memoir called Naturally Tan. And in it, he writes about growing up in England, about marrying what he describes as a Mormon cowboy. He also dishes out some fashion advice in the book. I mean, how could he not? And he knows some people find fashion frivolous and shallow.
I find it laughable. I do when people, I mean, don't get me wrong, some people are ridiculous when it comes to fashion. Yeah. And they take it way too seriously. We're not curing cancer. We're putting clothes on people. However, it can have such a huge effect on the way you carry yourself and the way you are perceived that I think assuming that fashion or style is shallow is one of the most silly notions I've come across in a long time. I mean, I've heard this since I was a kid. When I said to my parents that maybe one day I'll work in a factory, it wasn't that I wanted to work in a factory. It was that I wanted to work with clothes. My parents saw it as ludicrous that I would think that clothing is important enough to build your life around it. It is.
Your parents, you grew up in South Yorkshire.
I did.
Your parents had a love marriage, which was kind of unusual for their culture.
Yes, shocking.
Shocking. What were the lessons you took from that, do you think?
To not feel restricted and forced by your community. Mm. We are, especially within communities of color, they're usually quite tight-knit. Yeah. Or communities with religion, they are usually quite tight-knit. And so it's not just your family that you're trying to appease, it's your whole community. And with my parents, they were able to go against the grain and did something that truly made them happy and probably displeased their parents. But they knew for the sake of their own happiness, it was important to them. And that was really important to me as a child. I remember thinking, I've never seen this anywhere else in my community other than in my own home. That set a tone for how resolute I was about my own life.
It's interesting, too, that you say it wasn't a particularly religious upbringing, but you did go to mosque 3 hours a day.
Yeah, okay, here's the thing. For me, in my community, we weren't seen as super religious.
Yeah.
But for anyone who's not part of our religion, yeah. We seem like crazy folk.
Right.
But it didn't seem super religious. I felt quite liberal compared to my immediate community. They were a lot more strict with their children. They weren't allowed to do the things that we were allowed to do. Like, yes, we weren't encouraged to watch a white TV. I've got my air quotes up again. We weren't encouraged to watch white TV, but we were allowed to watch it. We weren't encouraged to listen to English music, but we were allowed to. Whereas in other homes I knew, that was forbidden completely. And so we were quite, and the fact that my parents got a love marriage, that was radical. That went so against the religion.
You watched plenty of quote-unquote white TV.
Yeah.
A lot of it. And it seems like your vocabulary, your sense of being world-wise as a very young kid, mm-hmm. was that something you drew from popular culture? And what were you looking for in popular culture, do you think?
I was looking for escapism. I was looking for a life that I didn't really have access to in my own community. Yeah. We weren't really encouraged to have Caucasian friends because their values were very different. But I was raised in England. I was going to school with Caucasian people and I was fascinated by their lives. And so I was looking to learn what life was outside of my own community. And I did. And my parents mostly spoke Urdu or Hindi or Punjabi in the house. And so we were discouraged from speaking English in the house. With my parents, my dad in particular, if he heard me speaking English with my siblings, he wasn't overly happy about it. And so I learned my vocabulary mostly from from the TV I was watching, and I wasn't watching things that other kids are watching. I was watching grown-up shows. And so I excelled at English in school, even though English was my third language at home.
You write about kind of adjusting your accent or certainly being aware mm-hmm. of that, mm-hmm. aware of your persona, aware of...
Yeah.
So have you always been that way, aware of the way you present yourself?
Yes, always. It wasn't something I desperately wanted to do. I don't speak like any other South Yorkshire person. I'm hyper aware of that. And neither do a couple of my siblings. Because when we would say something in a Yorkshire accent, my dad would get very frustrated saying that is not the way you do this. The way you excel in life is by speaking
more posh.
It wasn't posh. It was just non-regional English.
Right.
Posh was going to be obviously fake.
Yeah.
But non-regional, my dad, he said it from a very, very early age. And I don't know why you would tell a 5 or 6 year old person this, a child this. But if you want to get a good job, if you want to marry well, you will speak correctly. And so there was no Yorkshire accent allowed in the house.
Did you feel, not religious expectations, but you felt cultural expectations?
Yeah.
Clearly, if your father is telling you at 5 years old, mm-hmm. you got to get the accent right mm-hmm. to present yourself. Mm-hmm. Was that a lot of pressure?
I felt pressure to not present as Asian as I am. In England, we're referred to as Asian. Just for any of you listeners out there in Utah, I call myself Asian. I know that you guys would say I'm South Asian or Middle Eastern. I felt a lot of pressure to hide my ethnicity as much as possible because my dad reminded me, and he wasn't trying to be hateful. He was absolutely correct that the less Asian we present in our vocabulary, in the way we behave, the more likely we will to be successful. Mm.
You right up front in the book, you talk about how to the question of when did you know you were gay?
Mm-hmm.
It's like you had no aha moment. You mm-hmm. had no sort of moment of realization necessarily on one hand. And you were so matter of fact about it
mm-hmm.
in the way you write about it. But then you also write about how when you were 13, you did have this kind of realization.
Mm-hmm.
So it seems like there's this certainty, this kind of sense of being sure of yourself, and but then also you did have to go through the usual questions. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, it. And I understand why it worked that way. I always knew who I was. There was a time when I was attracted to boys and girls. And so it wasn't really a coming out. It was more of a, oh gosh, I don't even know how to articulate it. I realized, oh no, women can now fall by the wayside. That's not what I want. Yeah. Whereas before then, I thought maybe I would go both ways. And I was just trying to figure my life out as a kid. But then there came a time when it was very clear, yes, it was definitely only boys at that time I was attracted to. I would have to come out to my family or explain to them that I wasn't going to live the life that they expected. It was a really worrying time that there was nobody that lived my life on TV, in movies, in my immediate community. There was nowhere to look for it. And so, yeah, panic really set in, thinking, I know I'm going to live my life that way. I refuse to live my life any other way. But how the heck am I going to tell people?
And you made a plan, which you knew part of that was going to be hiding this part of yourself, at least for a while.
Yeah. I knew I was going to hide it from my parents for the rest of their lives. I thought that I would have to hide it. But from my siblings, I thought when I'm older, I'll tell them, but I'm going to try and distance myself from my family as much as possible. So it's as easy to digest as possible. Again, we don't have the luxury of normalcy of the gay community in our community, whereas many other communities do have that luxury.
But this was the thing that was so interesting too. You write this, that you learned to hide away, this is how you put it, any trait that might give away your sexuality because you were too busy trying not to make your ethnicity such a big issue.
Yeah. And I stand by that completely, and it's something I've thought about for years and years and years. When people ask me if I was bullied for being gay, the answer is no. Like, people were so consumed by my color that they weren't overly concerned about what sex I may be more attracted to. They were too busy focusing on the very obvious, which was the fact that I'm brown and I don't belong in their country as far as they were concerned. And so me hiding my sexuality wasn't for the outside world. It was for my family and my extended family, who I was very close with and still I'm very close to. And so I would find ways to make sure that I presented as straight as possible.
The ethnic part is interesting to me. So when you were born, do you figure you are, as you say, brown, but also light-skinned? Is that fair to say? I'm interested in the part of the book where you talk about how that's like the first question. Is he fair? Is she fair?
Yeah. You, I'm sure, would say fair-skinned, and many people do class me as fair-skinned. For my family, I was dark.
Huh. And that was a disappointment, do you think?
Yeah, for everyone. Yeah. I have a few dark cousins also. I have another brother who was... we were both darker as children. We lightened up as we got older. And that wasn't because of skin bleaching. I did bleach my skin at one point for a few days when I was 10. I don't remember the exact time. I was around about 10. And it hurts like a mother lover. And so I stopped. but there were a few of us in our extended family who were dark skinned. And we were definitely the ones that people stayed away from. And I remember distinctly, I started an Instagram account recently where I want to share these stories and have other people share their stories of how disgusting this is within our own communities. I remember distinctly somebody saying, it was a great aunt who said, well, the problem is you keep letting him eat chocolate. And I was like 5 or 6 and thought, oh gosh, I've got to stop eating brown foods. That's why I keep staying this color. And then after a few weeks of trying to eat mostly pale foods, I realized my color's not changing because of this. Well, that's incredibly taxing on a child. When you're 5 or 6, the last thing you want to be considering is how to make your skin as fair as possible so you're seen as a desirable candidate for a child.
It's so interesting, too, though, you say that it wasn't because of fear or hatred as much as it just was about status and class.
Yeah. I mean, class is very important in South Asian communities, very, very important. There's still the class system in Pakistan and India. Yeah. And you guys, thankfully, do not have that here at all. It seems ludicrous and archaic because it is. But as a child, it was very clear that if I wanted to have a decent status where people would actually want to employ me or marry me, I better lighten up real quick.
You say in the book that the white kids you knew were able to take a pride in their appearance in a way the South Asian kids weren't.
Yeah.
Attractiveness was not on anyone's agenda in our community, you say.
Yeah, it's discouraged. You want to be attractive in that you have fair skin.
Yeah.
But you don't want to be sexy. That's definitely not something you should ever strive to be. And it's funny now that I'm older and I don't live in my old community and I'm not as engrossed in that the oppression as I felt as a kid. I definitely strive to be sexy as anyone does. I do want to be seen as desirable as anyone does. And I think it's a very natural feeling to want to be desired by people you're attracted to.
Mm.
But that was something that everyone discourages, not only within the South Asian community, but in the Muslim community, modesty first. And so, yes, you can be physically attractive, but you should downplay that.
But then here you are, going to your grandfather's denim factory, knowing that there was something there that was exciting about fashion and appearance.
Mm-hmm.
Having to, I guess, sort of keep that to yourself in some
yeah.
ways, but also wanting to have, as you said, when you were a kid, multiple wardrobe changes
yeah,
every day.
Every day. I saw the power of clothes so early on, that most people don't have the luxury of seeing that. And I think that's why I'm in the position I am today, and why I'm able to encourage people on a global show very successfully, the importance of making the right wardrobe choices to put yourself in the best position possible to achieve the success that you want. And it's not that, oh, that great suit's going to get you that PhD and you're going to become a doctor. No, it's what will dressing a certain way do for your self-esteem that will then have a knock-on effect with the way you present at school, how you are perceived at school, if you're going to get a certain job, a certain girlfriend, whatever. I saw that when I was like 5 or 6. I saw this bolt of fabric. I saw it become a piece of clothing, and I knew how that piece of clothing could change the way I saw my future.
What is that awareness about, do you think? Is it...
For me, it was hope.
Oh, really?
For me, it's hope. It was a hope of a future I never thought possible before that.
What do you mean?
Before dressing this way, before putting on the clothes from my granddad's factory, I was mostly wearing some shalwar kameez, which is something I talk about in the book. Mm. And I knew that what that life would bring me. It would bring me comfort within my own home. It would bring me a very modest life as a partner. It would encourage me to potentially pretend to be straight for the rest of my life, marry a lovely Pakistani girl, have children, and live the life that was set forth. These clothes made me feel like I can hope, I can dream, I can put that on, I can feel better about my life, I can start to experiment with the person I am, I truly am inside, even if I don't let anybody see me in that. And that play, that self-assurance can then encourage me to move out of my parents' home, to live my own life, even if it's in secret, and then marry the person I want to marry. It offered me hope.
Do you think... How many people do you think throughout the world have a sense of the way they want to dress, the way they want to be, their own sense of style, and don't dare?
Oh, my gosh. In my immediate community, probably almost every person. And so I'm assuming that almost everyone on the planet who is in a community that is so stifling. I love my old community. I'm not trying to denigrate my community. I love them. But there are many things within a tiny community that are very oppressive. And that's one of them. It robs you of your hope and encourages you to fit into the mold.
What's the gift that you think you have? Is it observation? Is it you're looking for shapes? Are you looking for color? Is it you can put them all together in the right way?
I think proportion. Color isn't my biggest concern. It's proportion and making you view your body differently. Everybody has body hang-ups.
Yeah.
I just know how to hide mine better than most.
So it's an awareness of that.
Yes.
you were going through, you write about this in the book, you were going through these old belongings and you came across some papers from high school, record of achievement, and you found this letter, and this is what you say in the letter. You write, "I want to study psychology and sociology at university, but my true passion has always been to be in show business. My hope is to be a host or a presenter on TV someday." Now, you are 17 years old at this time.
It blew my mind. I had not seen this since I was 17. My mom showed me this a couple of years ago as I was writing the book. I do not remember ever thinking those things. I remember wanting to be a to be a Bollywood star.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember that.
You
remember
that, sure.
Yeah, but that's, I mean, I think most kids want to be an actor or a singer or something. They want to be famous. When they're kids, they're like, oh, that must be wonderful. But I don't think I ever wanted to be a presenter or a host. So it's weird that I said that.
What do you make of that?
I guess I was more resolute than I thought as a child. I don't know. I guess I had dreams that I wasn't pushing for so greatly, but I'm glad that I now do.
The performance part. I mean, there early on, as you say, you wanted to go to Bollywood. You wanted to be in Bollywood. You wanted to be. You didn't have the dancing part down. You couldn't act.
No,
and you say.
And I don't read Hindi, and you have to be able to read a
right,
script.
Right.
I speak it, but I don't read it.
But you had a grand plan.
I mean, had a
so
grand
clearly.
Plan.
So was this the ham in you? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Maybe I just needed to find a way to perform, and being a presenter or a TV host was the only way I could do it because Bollywood wasn't going to happen. However, what I do find interesting in that is that the start of that sentence is very much who I was meant to be, who I was encouraged to be. I was meant to be a doctor. They are my options. You are a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer. They were the options. So I do find it interesting that even at 17, I was still hyper aware of the restrictions of my culture.
Tell me about that camel colored jacket you had made. You were 15 years old. 15 years old, went to a tailor to have custom made clothing.
Yeah.
Tell me about that. I know you've lost it now.
But
tell me about it.
I was a strange boy. When other boys were out doing gosh knows what, getting girls, playing football, whatever, I was there designing clothes to have made by a local tailor, a lovely lady called Thelma. I saw the power of what that could do for my confidence and where it could take me. And so I had wanted to have clothes tailored for many years. I knew how to sew. I knew how to sew many things. But there were certain things I just couldn't do, like a very well-tailored jacket. And I had desires to have this made for years, but I couldn't afford it. However, at 15, I started my first job. My first job was at a bookstore. I would read books to children on a Sunday, and I managed, sometimes on a Saturday, and so I managed to earn enough money to have a coat made. And gosh, bless her soul, she's probably not around anymore, but she gave me an incredible discount because she just hadn't met any child that was as excited about clothes as she was. And so I started having clothes made, not regularly because it was expensive even then, but I would have clothes made relatively regularly, more than most people I've ever met.
Tan France, he's in the Netflix series Queer Eye. He's also a resident of Salt Lake City. We're talking about his memoir, Naturally Tan. We'll take a break and come back in a minute. This is Radio West.
This week on Preach, the two guys who met on a Bible college puppet team and then built a Christian media empire.
Hi, kids, and welcome to VeggieTales. I'm Bob the Tomato, and I'm Larry the Cucumber.
VeggieTales is a cartoon that used wacky singing vegetables to teach kids about the Bible. It was huge in the 90s, and then it went bankrupt. Now it's making a comeback. Listen to Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today, Tan France is our guest. He's part of the popular show Queer Eye. You may also know he's a Utahn these days and not a casual resident. He loves the place. Tan has written a memoir about his life and how fashion helped him embrace his true identity. It's called Naturally Tan. So by 17, you write in the book, you decide you're going to try to make a life in fashion.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know what that meant? I mean, were you thinking designer? Were you thinking purchaser?
I would like to believe that I was more logical than most people at 17. And so
you were the reliable one, right?
I was always the reliable son. Or a reliable child.
Yeah.
I was 40 when I was 10, and I've always been that person.
Yeah.
And every child I've ever met has their teenage years, and there's pretty much no escaping it. They will be nightmares as children.
I know what you mean.
They will become aggressive. They will become combative. I skipped those years. Mm. I was always my mom. And so at 17, I planned what my life would be. And if I wanted to be successful in fashion, it wasn't as a buyer or a designer as most people were wanting to do who were studying the same course as me. They wanted to be the next Alexander McQueen. I knew that pretty much every one of them was going to fail at that. It was very clear. And so I decided that I was going to be a mass apparel designer. I wanted to learn how to design. And then I was going to take enough jobs in enough places where I could learn on the job how to make clothing for mass retail.
So which was harder, telling your family that you were gay or telling them that you wanted to work in the fashion industry?
Equally hard.
Is that right?
Equally hard. And I know that sounds ludicrous for most people listening to this. I know. However, when you are raised in a South Asian community, trying to tell your parents that you're not going to be a doctor is basically saying to them, I will disappoint you for the rest of your lives.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was a really hard conversation to have. Really hard conversation to have.
But you're good at persuasion. You did. You talked to them.
I've always been very persuasive.
Yeah.
By the time I had to tell my mom I was studying fashion, it was relatively easy to persuade her. And let me tell you why. I wasn't like most 17-year-olds. I had mapped out what I was going to do. And I told her that I would find a way to make her proud and make her prouder than she would ever be, even if I were a doctor. And by that, I mean I will not slack. I won't just... I won't just sell a t-shirt from the back of my car, which is funny because she thought that's what I was doing, even though my company had become very successful. She doesn't quite understand what fashion is, and she assumed I was printing t-shirts for a living, which is so silly. And I convinced her. I said, look, I want you to allow me the freedom to do this. You know I'm not silly. You know I'm not I'm not experimental for experiment's sake. If I'm going to experiment with something, it's because I'm moving on to something much greater, and I will make you proud, and I will be your most successful child, which I know is arrogant to say. However, my siblings were accomplished, and I couldn't allow her to believe that me going against the grain would mean failure and for her to worry. And so I said, look, if I do this, I will not just do it lackadaisically. I will work harder than any one of your children to prove my worth. Every day, I think of the importance of proving my worth to my family and my community.
It's like there's this theme I detected in the book. On one hand, there is this incredible sense of self-confidence. Mm-hmm. You're really sure of yourself. You're the surest of your siblings,
yeah,
you talk about. Incredible sense of bravery about the clothes that you chose. Mm. And then on the other hand, there's this self-doubt that you write about, this part of you that that fear, you say, that I guess we probably all feel, but you felt it really acutely, of being someday someone's going to discover that you're an imposter.
Yeah.
You're a fake.
Yeah.
What is that? There are those two things that are, I guess maybe we all have that, but it seems like there's that theme.
There's many reasons, and it all stems from childhood. And I was at the Emmys were a couple of days ago. Mm. And I went to an Emmy party afterwards, many Emmy parties afterwards, and one of them was the Netflix party. And it's for Netflix talent. And Amy Poehler was there. And I know Amy, and we were talking about NPR, actually, funnily enough. We were talking about NPR. And she was asking how things went. And I said, it went really well. I can't believe they wanted to interview me. And she said, that makes no sense. Like, you're on one of the most successful shows on the planet. That makes no sense to me. And my book had done incredibly well. Why wouldn't they want to talk to you?
Yeah.
And I said, I'm not this person, I'm not a showbiz person, I'm tan, Pakistani tan from South Yorkshire. I keep waiting for security to come get me. And even at the Netflix party, I felt like security might come and tell me, hey, don't be ridiculous, you absolutely do not belong here. Get out, what are you doing?
So when you first arrived in Salt Lake City, what did you make of it? Like, well, first of all,
I'm so glad we're talking about Salt Lake. I love this city. I love this state more than I've ever loved any place I've ever been to. The first time I came to Salt Lake, I remember distinctly within the first hour feeling like I was at home, which I traveled so much before coming to Salt Lake. With my jobs, I traveled all over the world, more than anyone I'd ever met. And I had never found a place that felt like home more than England. And then I came to Salt Lake, and within the first hour, I turned to my friend and I said, this is going to be my home one day. I will live here. And he thought that I was joking. And I said, I don't know what it is, but I did know what it is. I just don't want to say it. I feel more comfortable here than I've ever felt before.
Wait, what do you mean you did know what it
was? I knew what it was. this is so stupid, but this shows my where my head was at the time. I was at Chili's, and no shade to Chili's, but I haven't been back since. It's definitely not my place, but that I had never heard of it before, and this is where my friend had taken me. It's on 4th South. You know the one.
Yeah.
It's not far from here at all. And I was there, and this was probably 13, 14 years ago, so there weren't that many English people here, and there definitely weren't that many brown English people here, and sat down, ordered my food, and the server was lovely and just really excited that I was there. I was nobody, but I was foreign and I spoke with an accent that she liked from TV, and I had skin color that she hadn't really seen much of before, and she was very excited. And then people at the other tables wanted to say hello and ask what I was doing in town, and somebody gave me their number, a woman, she was clearly confused. And I just felt for the first time not nervous that somebody was going to say something racist, not nervous that somebody didn't want me in that establishment because I was Pakistani, not nervous that somebody was going to call me a terrorist as they walked by. Like, just being sat there thinking, nobody's going to call me a disgusting name. Or the opposite, they find me desirable here. I had never felt that before. And at the time, I was probably 22, and I'd never felt that before.
Do you still feel that way?
No. I feel like the belle of the ball in Utah, because the people here are lovely. They're more open-minded than a population I've ever come across before. They embrace my color. They see it as attractive as opposed to a character flaw. And they see my ethnicity, the fact that I'm English, as something to be embraced, as opposed to in England being ethnic was something to be discouraged.
I think some people might be surprised to hear you say that you found Utah to be open-minded just because there's a predominant conservative religious culture.
Yeah.
Some feel repressed by it.
Yeah, I know.
So, but you don't.
I've never experienced that.
You've never experienced that yourself. But I also wonder if in some ways growing up in a conservative religious culture influences the way you perceive that you perceive it differently. Maybe because
I come from a close-knit community, I know how judgmental it can be. However, and people may experience that in their immediate communities here. However, I see it as a relatively religious community and a community as a whole, but I don't see it as stifling as the community I came from. So I see how liberal it is compared to mine. And the religion is more liberal here compared to my own. And so, yeah, I see it as a lot more open-minded. Also, almost every friend I have here, actually every friend I have here is a staunch Mormon. Almost every friend I have here is a garment-wearing Mormon. And they are the most supportive friends I've ever had in my life. I have a group of 12 friends who I still see, even if I'm home for 18 hours, which is actually quite common these days. I've only spent 9 days in Utah this year. I see them every day I'm home. They are the most formidable people I know. And they also are Mormon. And so I think there's good people this is common knowledge, there's good people and bad people in every community, in every religion. Thankfully I'm surrounded by good people in this religion.
It's kind of lovely to hear you so careful about protecting your Mormon friends and your Mormon family.
Yeah.
Rob, your husband, grew up Mormon.
Mm-hmm.
His family, all for the most part, I'm guessing.
Pretty much.
Devout Mormon. Yeah. So you feel really protective.
I'm very protective of my family, yes. And I'm protective of my Muslim family also. Mm. Do I agree with everything in either of those, both of those religions? Absolutely not. Do I respect them completely? Yes, I do. Religion is tough for me, really tough for me, because I am part of a religion that absolutely most people would say goes against my lifestyle. However, the religion I was part of and am part of, for me personally, is very important, and the connection I have with the person, with the being that I was led by my whole life, is still that being, and that being is the most loving. And so I see people within a religion or a community as fallible. We are people. They have their own judgments. That's their problem. That's not my God's problem. And so when family aren't as open-minded, I'm not angry at them. I just think you are so stuck in the realms of the religion and the book and what your community expects of you. I'm not super angry at those people. I understand. I was very, very active in my Muslim faith, and I knew that if I was part of a life that went against the religion, I was supporting that, and that is a very real part of my faith, my family's faith, and I know how difficult that is for them, and it's a real quandary for them. And try to reconcile me and their religion is hard, and I would never want them to feel like they have to choose, because I feel like there's a way of marrying two, both of those things. And that's how I feel about my Mormon family too. And thankfully, my family and my husband's family are the same way Rob and I are. They've managed to reconcile being part of religion, not believing in every part of it, but reconciling things with their God and still being part of our lives. And that's how I feel about my own too.
It's like, I wonder if you and Rob, for you, you've taken the part of religion that's about love and compassion.
Yes.
And you just disregard the rest.
I disregard hate. I disregard hate in every facet of my life. That has no place for me. I say this a lot.
But the God part is important to you, or whatever it is
Spirituality is important for both of us. It's not necessarily channeled through any particular religion. It's just I believe in God, and I believe in something much greater than myself. And I've said many times, and since I was very young, I refuse to be the reason I'm unhappy. I will not allow myself to be the reason I'm unhappy, and so I don't surround myself with hate or negativity.
Okay, I want to ask you about Queer Eye.
Yeah.
And I know that, so you go through this series of auditions. And there's there were thousands of people up for this.
Yeah, I think 12.
And there's this moment when they're trying to test various things. Your chemistry between the five, mm-hmm. all of that. And there's this story that you tell in the book when you're going through this process, where they have these questions in a fishbowl.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't want to play along with this game.
Let me tell you why. So it's like speed dating. There were four tables, yeah. and every table had like a creator. There were four creators of Queer Eye, three actually, three creators of Queer Eye, and then a bunch of Netflix executives, producers, casting people. And so at each station, you would have maybe three or four people. And so you would make your way around these four stations. Every 10 minutes, you would move on to the next station, just like speed dating. But because my name starts with T, I was one of the last people that was called up for this. And so I would watch these people go up, who were all in the same room sat, and they were at they were on a stage. And we couldn't hear their answers. We could just see what they were doing. Mm. And I'd become friendly with many of the men that were there. There were 42 men.
Wow.
And they would come down and they would talk about what some of the questions were. Really nice. And the questions were fine, but so boring and would give you no information about who I am as a person. And so it really wasn't a plan. I got to the table and it was one of the main creators of Queer Eye and one of the heads of Netflix. And I sat there and they said, okay, pick a question. I was like, I'm not going to pick a question. I'm so sorry. I've watched all of these men answer these questions that, in my opinion, are just ridiculous. I was like, what do you want to know about me? What are you going to learn about me from a fishbowl question that's asking, when was the last time I flew a kite? I couldn't care less about the last time I flew a kite. And so I said, I would like to have an honest conversation with you. And if you really want to know how I do in a conversation, here goes. I heard you just got divorced recently. Can you tell me about it?
Wow.
How long were you married?
Wow.
What was the catalyst for it? And the guy was like, wait, are you serious? Like, you truly are not going to answer those questions and you're asking me about my divorce? And I was like, yes, I don't like small talk.
I'm British.
And I don't mean to be offensive when I ask that. I truly want to get to know you and I would like for you to get to know me. And so I'm going to start and I want to show you how comfortable I am. And then you can ask me whatever you want. So I'm going to ask you whatever I want to ask you. You ask me whatever you want to ask me. There's no holds barred. And at that moment, he reminded me, this was on our first day of the auditions, he reminded me after I got the job, and just a few days ago, funnily enough, he was like, that's the moment you got the job.
There was this story you tell about in the early days when you were shooting, and the producers, they were basically, I can't tell exactly what they were, if they were saying, Tan, you're being too British, but they were saying you've got to Americanize this a little bit.
I don't do this is gonna be really offensive for a lot of people who are listening to your show. I don't do American cheese well. a lot of American shows do the, I'm just gonna make the noise, hello. I don't do that. I'm like, hello, nice to meet you. How are you? There's so much jazz handiness going on that's not very English. We don't like to ham it up a lot. And so we were doing the final part of the audition, which is basically an episode of Queer Eye when we first go into the house and we meet the person for the first time. And then they take us into individual sections, which is, for me, a wardrobe. And during that, I was going through his clothes and I was asking him questions. And they're like, can you ham it up? Like, we need American. And then finally, I simply barked, I'm not American. If you want an American, go get one. I'm English. I will do this the way I feel comfortable. If you don't like that, I do not need this job. I didn't want to audition for this job. You made me and I'm here. If you like it, you like it. If you don't, I'm out. And that's how I felt. I wasn't trying to be arrogant. It was very clear. I didn't need the job. I wanted the job. I didn't really understand. Well, let me tell you this. I didn't want the job for this reason. I may as well be honest. I didn't want the job because I was worried about the pressure. Mm-hmm. I was massively worried about the pressure of what that might mean for me as a person. And so that's kind of why I didn't want the job. I love my job. I love my job so much. I'm the luckiest boy in the world. But at the time, I was scared of the job. And so somebody telling me to be more American just made me think, okay, I don't need this. I've got a very happy life back home. I just retired. I do not need this. And I definitely won't be somebody you want me to be. I will be myself only. And again, that worked really well for them. It set the tone for who I was going to be on the show. And there is a difference between me and the boys. I love my boys very much. But they are very, I know Anthony's not technically American, he's Canadian, but as far as I'm concerned, same, same. Yeah. I can't tell the difference. there's a different tone with me. When there's a difficult conversation that needs to be had, I'm brought in. When there's something that needs to be said that is way too honest and could be quite painful for the person to hear, I'm brought in. There's a way that the British do things that I think is a little more palatable for our audience.
So can I read you one of my favorite quotes from Simon Doonan?
Yes.
Because I want to get a sense of if you have a philosophy for fashion. So somebody had said that Simon Doonan, who's very flamboyant the way he dresses, he says, look, I know I look like a wanker. I enjoy looking like a wanker. Looking like a wanker, he said, is a basic human right, and it's a huge part of having a signature style. And he writes this, I never subscribe to the idea of good taste. That's a subjective concept promoted by fashion scribes to oppress the rest of us. So he has the sense of, even within a very free mm-hmm. play, I've always liked that. And I wondered, what do you think about the idea of fashion on one hand being this thing that ascribes a kind of taste, and yet the other hand being something that frees you.
I agree with him. And I've mentioned this on the show in season one. I couldn't care less about what's fashionable and what the industry suggests that we should be wearing that season. If it makes me feel good and it makes me stand tall, that's what's most important. And that's what I encourage on the show. I don't care if somebody's plus size and they're told by the industry, and they have been told by the industry for many, many years, that they need to wear, a woman needs to wear something A-line to hide those hips that are larger than somebody else's. No, if you want to wear a bodycon dress, wear a bodycon dress. It makes you feel wonderful, wear it. And so that's what I push for on the show, is feeling wonderful in whatever you're wearing, even if it's not my style. Gosh, we've had so many heroes on our show whose style is not my style. It doesn't matter. It's subjective. I want you to feel good in something that you gravitate towards. I'm just going to show you how to wear it well.
Yeah. You say several times in the book, you want kids.
Yeah.
And it's interesting how you also write about being a traditionally minded person. And I guess Rob coming from a traditionally minded culture, you guys are on the same page.
We are. That was one of the many reasons I fell in love with him. He has very similar values to me, and he has similar hopes for his life. And he wants to be a dad, and so do I.
Do you think about what's next? I know you're still dealing with Queer Eye, but you say in the book there's a lot of self-doubt, a lot of ego involved. It's a version of myself I've never known before. You're asking, what's the... And you're getting offers.
Yeah.
So what do you explore? What do you not explore? How are you thinking about that now?
You know, I've become really comfortable with saying no, which I never thought I would be. I've always been very boundary-led. If I'm not comfortable with something, I make that very, very clear. But when it came to show business, because I'm so new to this, this isn't my world, or this wasn't my world. And so I felt like a guest here, and I better just be polite and smile and say yes. And that was the case 2 years ago. The show's now been out for a year and a half, and within the last year, I've become very comfortable saying, I will not do this, and you will not ask me again. And I will not behave this way, and you will not ask me again. And I will not do that interview, or I will not do that part. And it's put me in a position that I'm very comfortable with. And it's not me being difficult. It's not me being a diva. It's me saying, this is not going to be additive to my life, and this is not going to make me happy. And my happiness is of utmost importance to me and my life. And so I now have 3 shows with Netflix, and I want to continue exploring those. I want to continue exploring different facets of my personality, and that's what these 3 offer me. One of them, I get to play with comedians, and I love being very playful, and I'm very silly, and it brings out the kid in me, and I love doing that. The other one is fashion based. It's a fashion competition show, and it meets those needs that I have that so desperately want to play with design again. And then I have Queer Eye that gets me what I really wanted to do in this space, which is offer a different perspective of who my people are.
Do you think this place, Utah, is this home?
It will be for the rest of my life. And you can ask me that again in 30 years and this will still be my home. I'm never as happy anywhere as I am when I'm in Salt Lake.
One more question. I loved this. You said in the book that you hope in your lifetime shows like Queer Eye would become archaic.
The reason why that's my hope, I know that it's almost impossible, is because it means that there is no longer the divide that we have, not only in our country, in the world, where people hate each other based on their political affiliations, where they hate each other based on their perceptions of the LGBTQ community or race. What we do now is we help bridge those divides and remind people that we are all the same. We have many differences, I know, but we are the same in that we are one race, the human race, and we can always find commonality. And I hope that we live in a world, or my children or my grandchildren will live in a world where they look back at Queer Eye and laugh, saying, can you believe that the human race was silly enough to believe that we weren't one?
Tan France, thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Tan France. He's the fashion expert for the Netflix series Queer Eye. His new memoir is called Naturally Tan. Radio West is a production of KUER. Our thanks to our intern, Natu Twe. The program is produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Beck Fabrizio.